Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. This is the first part of a special series of podcasts tied in with our latest special issue, Proton Beam and Particle Therapy. In late 2018, the first patients in the UK will be treated at the Christie Hospital in Manchester with proton beam therapy, and in 2020 a second NHS centre will open in University College London Hospital. In this podcast, we'll be speaking with Professor Steve Hahn of the MD Anderson Cancer Centre and Professor Anthony Zeitman, based at the Mass General Hospital in Boston. They both offer unique perspectives on the experience with proton beam therapy in the US and what we can learn from this in the UK. Professor Hahn will cover many of the technical advances and challenges associated with this treatment, whereas Professor Zeitman will describe why proton beam therapy in the US is at something of a tipping point. First, we'll be hearing from Professor Steve Hahn. Professor Hahn, thank you very much for joining us. I just wanted to start by asking you to, in broad terms, just describe what proton beam radiotherapy is.
Proton beam radiotherapy is another radiation therapy modality that allows us to reduce the integral dose to normal tissues because of the presence of Bragg peak. So it's a physical dose issue related to this particle therapy. It has the same biological effectiveness as X-rays, so we have some comfort that the doses we're giving with protons are basically similar dose per dose, gray per gray, compared to photons. But the major difference is this decrease in the medium and low dose bath region, so the integral dose to the normal tissues. And so in certain circumstances, that reduction in integral dose can provide for a reduction in toxicity or potentially even a dose escalation, but more likely a reduction in toxicities.
You've alluded to some of the advantages to this technology. So are there any risks associated with proton beam radiotherapy?
So there's dosimetric costs, the most important being the fact that we have some range uncertainty as to where the proton actually stops in tissues. And so that range uncertainty makes us create an extra margin of safety around the target volume to ensure that we have full coverage. And that has a couple consequences. One is, unlike the medium and low dose regions, which tend to be lower with protons compared to photons, the actual high dose region around the target volume tends to be higher with protons than with photons, and particularly IMRT. So depending on the location of the tumor and where you actually draw it relative to critical structures, that can be an important and potentially toxic issue. It's why I do not think from a conceptual point of view that stereotactic body radiotherapy in the lung, for example, which has been touted as an example of where protons might be of benefit, because of this issue of relatively higher doses in proximity around sort of the plus 2 centimeters around the tumor, that would be of any benefit compared to a typical VMAT or IMRT, SBRT lung plan. So that's one negative. The other is the range uncertainty really dictates the sort of direction of the placement of the beams. And because you don't know where the end of the Bragg peak is, and there is potential for some high LET particles being there, you cannot have one single beam with the distal edge of the beam hitting a critical structure. So in that case, that's another negative with respect to protons. And any attempt to decrease those margins could be put in place, but because of the relative lack of onboard imaging and other techniques we use in photons, and that's getting better, that makes us even more concerned about the uncertainty because we don't want to miss the target. So those are some of the examples. I mean, obviously there's the cost issue as well. So we have to be very selective in how we apply this technology.
And with regards to the areas that we need to be cautious about in terms of high dose near to the target, do you think those things will be solved as we understand more about the physics behind protons, or are these sort of insurmountable challenges?
So I think they'll be solved to some extent. There's a really nice paper in medical physics from, I think, 2012, 2013, something like that. It's from the, I believe it's from the Mayo Clinic, where they did a planning study. Of course, you know, you can do anything in a planning study. But it's, you know, with IMPT, it's certainly better than it is with passive scattering. With better image guidance, I think we'll be able to reduce some of those margins. So I think to some extent that will be overcome, but, you know, we can't change the laws of physics, and so some of that will continue to be a problem. And I don't see, for example, some folks have touted, you know, centrally located lung lesions, where, of course, there's great toxicity if you hypofractionate too much for lung cancer patients early stage. In those patients, I just don't see us reducing that high-dose region around the target volume enough to actually make a difference in terms of the toxicity of SBRT. So I think we're going to have some physical limitations that we won't be able to get beyond.
Moving on now, so obviously you're probably aware one of the big things that's happening in the UK that we'll have two proton radiotherapy sites available. And so with your expertise and experience, I mean, what are the things that you've learned in terms of developing a proton beam radiotherapy service, and what can we learn from your experience there?
Well, first off, good for you. Asking that question is probably the most important thing, learning from others' experience. So there is a significant learning curve with proton therapy, as there is with any technology, and in terms of target delineation, in terms of dosimetry, in terms of assessing the plan. If you look at Jing Liao's paper about to come out on the phase 2 randomized trial of non-small cell lung cancer, what's very interesting about that trial is that learning curve is demonstrated in the outcomes of patients in that trial. So if you were an earlier patient on that trial, your outcome wasn't quite as good as later in that trial. And our hypothesis, which I think the data seem to bear it out, is that there is a substantial learning curve in terms of the application of protons for everyone, physicists, dosimetrists, therapists, and doctor. The first month, there's the first 3 months, there's the first 6 months and year, et cetera. And, you know, I think you stage your approach to starting patients. Your first patient should not probably be a pediatric patient, because, you know, you want to make sure that you've gone through a few patients and you've sort of set things up from a process point of view the right way. But even from a planning point of view and a delivery point of view, it's really good to get some external validation. And one of the things we did when I was at the University of Pennsylvania was that our first X number of patients in any disease site, we actually had the plans and the QA, et cetera, reviewed by people at outside institutions. So at the time it was Florida, MGH, et cetera, and even some folks at the PSI. So I think having someone look over your shoulder when you get started so that you don't make an error. And then the other thing is, I think it's also reasonable to put everybody on a registry trial where you take a pause after your first 10 to 12 patients and look back and make sure that you haven't seen any untoward toxicities. I think that's another important peer review and quality measure that is very helpful. And then, you know, from a very simplistic point of view, making sure that you're working closely with your vendor to have all updated technology, and that when new updated technology comes in, you'll be able to install that relatively simply into your facilities. You know, one of the mistakes that some folks have made with the early on equipment is that they didn't have that capacity, which means, of course, if they want to upgrade their equipment to modern equipment, they either have to shut the whole thing down or build a new facility. And that's not good. Obviously, you want a little bit more plug and play with the proton facilities than we've seen in the past.
Those are all really, really excellent points. Thank you very much for sharing that. And sort of looking at the next steps, really, what do you feel are really important and key research questions that we should be asking around proton beams from a clinical and also maybe from a radiobiological point of view? Because that's something that the UK is also trying to grapple with at this point.
I think, first of all, everybody should be on some sort of prospective evaluation of outcome. And I think that has to include the cost factor. So Stephen Frank has done a really nice job in the head and neck phase 2 randomized trial looking at this issue. He's looked at toxicity as the primary endpoint, survival as a secondary endpoint, but also the financial toxicity, if you will, as another endpoint. And the question is, are the episodic costs of care aligned with the favorable clinical outcomes we want? And is the upfront cost associated with protons ultimately going to lead to lower costs long term? In a place like the United Kingdom, where many of those costs are borne by the government, unlike in the U.S., where much of the cost is borne by insurance companies or its society through insurance companies, I would think that the U.K. would want to know the answer to that question, the government would. Whereas in the U.S., when we brought that up to some of these trials, because of the mobility issue in the U.S. where people move from job to job and insurance to insurance, there's not always a direct linear relationship between the upfront cost of a cancer treatment and the subsequent costs down the road, because that patient may move on to a different insurance plan. But nonetheless, I think it's in everybody's interest, if you have higher upfront costs for whatever reason, mostly technology training, et cetera, does that lead to a reduction in morbidity, increased cure rate, and then does that translate into lower cost of care? Stephen Frank has done this in his oropharynx trial. And of course, as you know, the HPV population is hitting a demographic of patients in the U.S. who hold jobs and who need to get back to work quickly, and swallowing and weight loss, et cetera, are really important toxicities. So he's incorporated this, and he's seen in his trial that by about 90 days after the initiation of treatment, the cost curves actually cross. And so that proton therapy actually becomes the same and potentially even lower cost in terms of episodic cost of care because of the less need for feeding tubes, speech and swallowing dysfunction, et cetera. So I think those are the sort of things that I would very strongly encourage. I think you're well positioned in the UK to do that. And of course, it goes without saying that we really do need to perform these phase two and phase three randomized trials so that we can actually get level one data to answer the questions. But not to underestimate the importance of cost in this and episodic cost of care and radiobiological. So I think it's pretty interesting what the folks at Penn, there's a few folks here at Anderson, but the folks at MGH have been working on in terms of, I mentioned to you the distal edge of the beam and the fact that there's high LET radiation in that. Could we potentially model, and I know that the folks at MGH, Hal Paganetti, have used Monte Carlo simulation, could we potentially model that to actually deposit the high-dose LET within the tumor as opposed to in the surrounding tissues and actually gain a little bit of biological edge compared to photons and potentially decrease the toxicity around the normal tissues surrounding it? So it seems like there could be a way there to actually, so that's just one area from a radiobiological perspective that I would encourage us to look at. And I think ultimately mixing photons with protons or protons with other heavy ions to mix and match the biological and physical features of them is another area that I think probably should be explored.
There's been a lot of talk about, arguably a controversy around what indications are best for proton beam radiotherapy. We know about a lot of the pediatric cancers, there's a lot of evidence behind that. But in the past, a lot of treatments were given for prostate cancer without strong evidence.
Yeah, well, ultimately it's going to be decided by randomized trials, not in the pediatric sphere, of course. Although, you know what, we are having a bit of a problem occasionally with insurance companies on the pediatric side, but I just don't think, given the importance of integral dose in pediatric patients, that we'll ever perform a randomized trial, nor do I don't have much equipoise there. So putting peds aside, in the major diseases, and particularly in the combined modality diseases where there is a significant amount of toxicity associated with combined modality therapy, and much of it in some settings related to the moderate dose of radiation to normal tissues, there's an opportunity to reduce toxicity. And I think, to me, number one on the list is oropharynx and other head and neck cancers because of the demographics there, the fact that there is such substantial toxicity, and because there are data from randomized trials showing that there is a relationship on secondary analyses between weight loss, feeding tube placement, and survival, that patients do worse, certainly from a patient-reported outcome point of view, but also from a survival point of view. And these are patients who can be cured. So I would start by focusing on patients who can be cured in the combined modality setting where there is substantial combined modality toxicity. So the other one would be esophageal cancer, where Stephen Lin shown in a phase 2 randomized trial a significant reduction in cardiac toxicity associated with protons. I think postoperative lung cancer, to the extent that people are still doing that, and we tend to do that, would be another area. I used to be high on stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer because of that toxicity, but Jing Liao's trial did not show a benefit, so I'm not really sure what the 3108 RTOG trial is going to show. I don't want to prejudge in prostate cancer, but I think that's a pretty heavy hurdle. I'm not sure I'd focus a lot of time on that. Alternatively, because we're seeing a lot of patients requiring post-op radiation now, that would be another setting because there is substantial toxicity there where protons might benefit, particularly bowel toxicity. And then I think we relatively unexplored the upper GI tract and GYN cancers, again, in the multi-modality setting. So I think there's great opportunity there to reduce toxicity in patients who have potential for being cured and therefore really improving the quality of life, long-term symptoms, and then also the episodic costs of care. That's where I think most of the emphasis should be at this point.
Next, we'll be hearing from Professor Anthony Zeitman.
Professor Zeitman, you say in your excellent editorial that proton beam therapy in the US is at something of a tipping point. What do you mean by that?
Well, proton therapy has an extraordinary history. I think there's no medical device that has a history anything like this one. Proton beam, as you know, has been around for 40 years, patients have been treated with protons. And for many years, we've felt that protons are the sort of natural point of the arrow when it comes to, you know, if you think of an arrow of progress, protons are at the tip when it comes to radiotherapy. You know, they're this incredibly accurate treatment. They're made for our image-guided age. And so if there were any normal medical device, we'd simply adopt protons and just use them in our clinics, and there'd be no problem and no questions would be asked. The problem with protons is that a proton facility is enormous. It's enormous in cost. It's enormous in terms of its footprint. There are actually few cities in Britain, few cities in the United States, that have the real estate, or few hospitals that have the real estate to accommodate a proton facility. So if an institution chooses to introduce proton therapy in its anti-cancer armamentarium, then because it's so expensive, you have to sacrifice something else. So there are a lot of ethical decisions involved in implementing protons. And for this reason, protons lay fallow for 2 or 3 decades. There were just a couple of places in the United States that had protons, no one else. And no one else was very interested. Then all of a sudden, there was an incredible confluence of events. In the United States, PSA screening was introduced in the early 1990s, and we had this extraordinary tsunami of prostate cancer cases, all of whom we then thought needed treatment. We had treatments that were available that were pretty crude. They were surgery, not being done well 20 years ago, and radiation in the 2D era. So all of a sudden, proton beam, which had been sleeping quite happily in a couple of academic institutions, was picked up as a potential way of treating this tidal wave of men with early prostate cancer. And it was a treatment that was going to be superior to anything else that was out there. And before you knew it, it had acquired a momentum of its own. You had the demand, which was being driven by the internet. You had vendors who were suddenly awake to the idea of making proton facilities, and they did. And so you had the demand, you had the vendors, you had institutions who wanted to put in prestige projects. In the United States, it's very different from Britain. Hospital adversary down the road, you have to have a bigger or a better device than they do. And there's advertising in the United States on billboards, so on the television. So there was this extraordinary brew in which proton therapy found a natural home. Now, the only problem here was that a proton facility was vastly expensive. So there were three ways in which you could afford to put a proton facility in. Firstly, if you just happen to have deep pockets. So my institution, the Mass General, the Mayo Clinic, they can just stick their hands in their pockets and come out with $200 million, no problem. But that's not many institutions. The second way would be through grants. And there aren't really many grants that would support a proton therapy unit. And the third way is what you might call creative finance. And companies cropped up that were prepared to finance the development of proton facilities. And in doing so, they provided the link between the vendors and the institutions. Now, they, of course, set the terms of the financing. And the terms of the financing were, you know, you don't have to put a penny down, they would say to the institutions, but we want our money back within 5 years, within 7 years. And so aggressive terms would be set. And these institutions that chose to put in Proton Beam, a big prestige project, instead of treating pediatric cases, for which there's a pretty good literature, were then essentially trapped into treating prostate cancer cases. Because for every child that you anesthetize and treat, you can probably treat five prostates. So when there are aggressive repayment terms with an investment company, institutions were trapped into treating men with prostate cancer. So it went from two institutions in the United States in 2003 to 26 right now, a huge sort of burgeoning. And as you're well aware, there are zero proton facilities currently open, at least in the United Kingdom, zero. So this huge expansion was driven by prostate cancer, driven by the internet, driven by creative financing. And now I get to why I think we're at the tipping point. Well, things have suddenly dramatically changed. The bottom has fallen out of the prostate cancer market. Men with prostate cancer are recognizing that they don't need treatment. Many of them could be managed by active surveillance. Surgery has improved vastly, and there's now robotic surgery. And robotic surgery is being as advertised as aggressively as proton beam therapy. So all of a sudden, there aren't the number of cases to support these proton facilities. And then, into the mix, the insurance companies and Medicare are saying, hang on, you have no evidence that proton beam is superior for prostate cancer, at least. We're not going to pay for prostate cancer treatment. So what you have right now is 26 proton facilities in the United States, many of whom are in desperate financial straits. One in Indiana has closed. Another one, possibly two, are in bankruptcy at the moment. Others will likely close in the not-too-distant future. So the big question is proton therapy, you know, a bubble that's about to burst? Or is it a balloon that's about to deflate and then reset at a more appropriate level? So it's a tipping point because we rapidly expanded the use of proton beam, and we did so without the simultaneous generation of evidence. So now the insurers, the payers, are holding our hands to the fire and saying, yeah, we'll pay for this, but give us the evidence. And we don't have it. So there's a crazy scramble now to develop the evidence to support proton beam. That's number one. And there's a crazy scramble to reduce the cost of proton therapy. And that means miniaturizing the machines, reducing their footprint, and more efficiently generating proton beams. So put that all together, we could crash and burn, very simply. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we'll get out of this. But that's where we are.
Well, that's all really fascinating. And so you alluded to the fact that you think we will get out of this. So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think there'll be a few ways out. First of all, there's likely to be right-sizing. Many of those institutions that purchased proton facilities went into fantastic debt and really had no business purchasing proton facilities, will go under. Now, one hopes they don't take the entire hospital under with them, but this was the gamble these institutions took. I think there are places, the big academic centers, like the Mass General, like the Mayo Clinic, like the University of Pennsylvania, that are just fine. We have no debt whatsoever. We'll be okay. We'll accept that we're not going to make any money out of protons. You know, it's a break-even proposition. But for us, with no debt, it'll be fine. And that's probably okay, because the complexity of protons is such that you need phenomenal amounts of physics support. And really, academic centers are the only places where protons probably should be. And there's another new model that's happening, and that's consortia. So, for example, in New York, four different academic institutions are coming together to cost share on a single proton facility. That's another way of reducing the burden. And then finally, I do actually think that the engineers and the vendors are going to work out ways of delivering protons more efficiently. So as you're probably aware, the original proton facilities all have three or four gigantic gantries and cost $150 to $200 million. There are now single room units that can be purchased for $20 to $30 million. I mean, it's still an awful lot of money, but you probably won't bankrupt your hospital with that. There are new gantry-free systems where you don't actually move the beam. It's a fixed beam, and you move the patient within the beam. That reduces the amount of space and the amount of hardware involved in protons. So I think some confluence of these things is probably going to save proton therapy. Now, the United States is very much looking to Europe, and in particular to nations like Britain, who are very late to the game. Britain's going to have its proton facility at the Christian, another one in London. So Britain's very late, but when Britain hits the ground, because there's a superb history of clinical trials and a superb trials infrastructure, I think Britain will likely do the kind of trials that are very much necessary, build up and support or not support the use of protons in different clinical scenarios.
What do you think are some of the key research questions that scientists and researchers in the UK should be asking with regards to proton beam therapy?
The first of all, the obvious comparative effectiveness questions. Does the improvement in a plan that you make when you're using protons as compared with, say, IMRT, does that translate into a real clinical difference for a real patient? There are situations when it probably does and situations when it probably doesn't. So that's one issue that's going to need to be sorted out big time. There are some basic biological questions. We used to think that proton therapy was all about the physics. You know, protons, just a sharper knife. Well, it turns out that isn't the case. And it turns out there's a lot of very interesting biology in proton beam. And the radiobiological effectiveness, the RBE, which we always assumed was 1.1, might be higher in some situations, lower in others. It depends on your fraction size. It depends upon the energy of the beam. It depends upon where you are on the Bragg peak. So the biology of protons, which we previously neglected, now has to be sorted out and has to be baked into the planning. And then there's a whole new iteration of protons, the so-called pencil beam scanning or intensity modulated proton therapy, which seems to take the technology to the next level. And again, we need trials to determine when and where should we be using intensity modulated protons.
So those are all really important questions, and hopefully they can be answered here in the UK. I guess, are efforts being made then in the US and centres like yourselves to be doing this? And what kind of areas are you really trying to champion at Mass General?
Well, the answer is yes, but In the mad scramble to open proton facilities, treat lots of patients, and pay back debt, there hasn't been an enormous amount of enthusiasm for comparative effectiveness trials, not in the United States. I'm very proud to say that the Mass General and UPenn, these two institutions, have actually led a randomized trial, IMRT versus protons, in prostate cancer. And now we've got several, I think five or six other institutions, proton facilities, that are coming in with us on this trial. We need 400 patients for about 250 down. So that trial will be over by 2019. So that's going to be fairly important. But we really need some trials in other sites, other more complicated sites, say head and neck, for example, or say lung, where it's really not clear whether protons are superior, inferior, or just the same. So there's plenty of work to be done. We're doing some of it, but by no means all of it.
I ended by asking both Professor Hahn and Professor Zeitman what they had identified at their centres as the big research questions facing the radiation oncology community at this present moment.
There's a couple of areas. One is we really have to turn our data into an asset. So we struggle in radiation oncology identifying, and particularly in the late toxicity, but all across all toxicities, who's going to develop late toxicities. And so which patients can we predict will develop late toxicities? And I think this is where large data sets analyzed appropriately with the statistical methods that avoid multiple testing biases and mixing that with genetic data, and in particular associating that with germline heterogeneities, I think that's a future where we'll be able to tie our decisions around dose, fractionation, normal tissue doses to what we know about the patient's germline status, as well as other clinical characteristics. And it's going to require a big data effort. It's just one example. We have a lot of trouble in radiation oncology addressing this issue of late toxicities. And although they're relatively uncommon, you know, given the number of patients we treat, I think it's a substantial burden. And if we could make those decisions prospectively and be confident that we're making those decisions based on real science and data, and no one's going to do a randomized trial. So those situations where we can't do a randomized trial, accessing big data and doing those analytics, I think, is really important. So that's one area. And then, you know, also developing biomarkers, whether it's imaging or blood-based biomarkers for late effects, some sort of surrogate so we don't have to wait 20 years would really be helpful as well. That's one. The second thing that I think is really important is that we have seen a significant change in our practice over the last 2 years, and that is we are treating many, many more patients in the metastatic setting. And you probably know of Daniel Gomez's phase 2 randomized trial looking at consolidation in lung cancer patients and those patients with oligometastases. And it turns out that there is a disease-free survival benefit from aggressively treating four or less metastases after the completion of chemotherapy. And we're looking at this in the targeted setting as well as the cytotoxic chemotherapy setting. Obviously, a phase 3 trial is required to answer this question definitively, but we're seeing a lot of these patients come through the door. Can you consolidate these lesions? We're using SBRT for the most part when we can, when it's medically appropriate. And so I think that as we see more of this occur with targeted therapies, I think we're going to really have to figure out who are the patients we should be treating, because I think just picking them on the basis of number of metastases isn't enough. Daniel's generated some really interesting correlative data showing that expansion of T-cell populations is associated with a better response to this sort of treatment. So our hypothesis is that there's an immune mechanism at work that enables us to use a relatively limited fractionation and treatment of metastases, and that can lead to prolonged survival. And so I think that's another area that we're focusing on, is who are those patients who are going to benefit from consolidation radiation, sort of flipping it on its head. Not curative, but more definitive approach to using this in patients that we can select appropriately with limited metastases. Then the other area is in combination with immune therapy. We're seeing more and more of this. We've got to perform biomarker-driven phase 3 randomized trials, and so that's another area that I think is of great importance. And then the last thing I'll just mention is that I think there is a benefit to other heavy particles that could potentially be seen for some patients with some tumors. My guess, and I don't know this, but my guess based upon understanding the physics and biology to some extent, and by no means am I an expert of heavy ions, helium, and carbon, is that the subset of patients who will benefit from this is even smaller than protons. And we've got a lot of work to do to figure out the late and early toxicities. It's another reason why this issue of late toxicity assessment is so urgent. But I do think that there could be a benefit to patients' heavy ions, a much more limited scope, and it's an area that we're really looking to move into in the next couple of years.
There are going to be a number of new technologies that really need to find their place. So it's not enough to just get proton beam. Everyone else is getting SBRT. So where does proton beam fit in relative to SBRT, relative to IMRT? We've got a lot of tools now. We've got to work out how best to use them. Then there's a big move towards hypofractionation, moderate hypofractionation, and extreme hypofractionation. So where does proton beam fit in relative to the other technologies there, if at all? Or is it a great way of reducing the cost of proton beam therapy? So there are a lot of questions around the new technologies that we have to answer. Then there's a whole world that's opening up in terms of oligometastatic disease. I'm sure in the United Kingdom, certainly in the United States, this is a big new field for oncology, and we're now starting to treat patients with oligometastatic disease with a kind of curative intent. Now, what technologies should we be using here? How do these different technologies and the different radiation doses, for example, fit in with the new systemic therapies, particularly immunotherapy? I don't know the answer to any of these things, but this is what we need to be looking at over the next decade, and we'll be looking at.
With this, I'd like to thank our contributors for their excellent and insightful commentary. In the next part, we'll be hearing from Professor Marco Durant and Professor David Sebag Montefiore on some of the physics behind charged particle therapy and how the UK is preparing for treating patients later this year. Look out for this podcast next month, and thanks very much for listening.